schedule because I gave you some of the wrong classes. We have to add these ones.
Yeah, you didn't have to take science if you're early.
Alrighty.
Or math.
Oh, I'm sorry. Actually, you guys weren't out in the hallway.
Were
you down the level? Gotcha. Well, I'm glad you found your way back. All right, so we got stuff to do, stuff to talk about. Good times. Can I go now? Well, I didn't want to cut you off at the pass. Because next class, you guys will all be talking, Lamanic's such a mean guy, over, Lamanic. All right, papers are due. When?
The 26th at 12:59.
12:59 a.m. or p.m.?
A.m.
What?
P.m.
Wow, you're mean.
You really just believe me. 12:59?
12:59. Yeah, okay, that's not going to work, obviously. The penalty starts kicking in at 11:59 p.m.
You just agreed to 12:59.
There was no such thing. No, it's not, because it's on a 24-hour clock. That's how I have to program it. So you actually have it at 23:59. That's the deadline. Military time. So, what happens after then? Can you submit it? Yes, you can. But you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to see the timestamp, and I'm going to say, oh, you're 1 second late, 5 points off.
That's so mean. What?
What's the deadline?
11:59 p.m.
I thought it was like 5 minutes late. It's like...
Who said that?
I was reading your guide.
Your website.
Who said 5 minutes late is okay? I didn't say that.
You look at your website.
No, I'm sure it says at midnight, it's late.
So,
make sure it gets in on time. Second, should you just willy-nilly drop it in? Or should you make sure you followed all the directions properly?
Make sure you follow all the directions.
Why?
Because...
Remember, this is not a writing. This is not a writing assignment. This is an assignment based on you following directions. And if you don't follow directions, you don't get a good grade. So make sure you go to prophylmanic.com, read through everything one more time. Make sure you didn't miss anything. Because again, word count being short, big points come off. Coming in late, big points come off. Improper formatting, big points come off.
I have a question.
Yes.
So, I've never used Chicago format at Amaria before, and I'm a junior, and I've had history classes before. Isn't the Chicago format for history classes?
Pretty much, yeah.
So the other professors just messed up.
I'm not going to say anything about my colleagues.
Okay.
But as for those of you who are aspiring teachers, remember, the best thing that you can do is try to expose your students to as many different modalities as possible. So my colleagues might be more comfortable using the other formats. You know, when I was an undergrad, and I'm not lying, all of my history and political science and legal professors, they were all 80 years old. They were all World War II, Korean War veterans. So that's what I had feet into my brain. So the reason why I do it is because I know you probably never had it before, and I just want you to try. Because if you go to grad school, you never know what the professor's going to want. So am I going to rip you to shreds if it's not 100%? No. The purpose is just to give it a shot. So if your footnotes are not proper, did I see you try? Are you close? Yes, you'll get credit for it. If you allow a couple of facts to get into your paper that aren't cited. Are you going to get enough? No. I do an approximation. You know, so I think I put, if you don't have enough insufficient, or if you don't have sufficient citations, I think it's like -5. But if you're like a little under, I may say like -2. I'll never go more than what's on there. So again, it's just guide in trying. Okay? Other questions?
What is the last day of this class?
What, you don't like me anymore?
No.
I'm sick of listening to your annoying voice, Lamanic. I just want to be done. Seriously?
No, not that.
Just is that how you pronounce your last name?
Lamanic, yeah.
That's not good. Okay, so.
What?
Lamanic.
No, it's not Lamanic. Lamanic. You're missing what letters? Lamanic.
Because it's the audience last, I'm always coming here for.
Good, yes. So our last in-person session is Tuesday, May 7th. Final exam is Thursday, May 9th.
So we have to be here Tuesday.
Have to be here Tuesday, you don't have to be here Thursday.
Because Thursday is online. Out Tuesday.
Well, Professor, we need time to study and go over the stuff. So I don't know. What do you think?
No. Tuesday class. Thursday, final. Unless you're a senior. Do I have any seniors? I don't think so. I think I only have one.
But for the most part, if somebody is sick, anything can happen.
Well, how many absences do you have? Are you at the point where you're going to start losing points?
No, I don't
have. Anything could happen. Okay.
How many absences can you get before you?
What does it say on syllabus?
I know you said four. But is it four and then points get taken off in the next one? Or is the fourth one your points get taken off?
Before that. So unless there's medical excuses or you had to go to sports or
so
something like that.
So if you have that fourth one, you won't lose points, but if you get that fifth one, you will.
Well, seeing how I think you're trying to work the system, I might say for you it's three.
Why?
If you have
done
the fifth times, that's what they're saying?
What?
You realize you're my only class if I come back on the 7th, right?
Good.
I don't have classes at all that week.
Good.
That's it. That's
so,
it.
But you can't. That's not fair. This is an assignment.
Not fair.
Yeah. I don't give projects or presentations or like that. I was told by my boss I have to work to the last day, and that's what I'm going to do. I'm following the calendar.
Yeah.
So. I'll leave you one more before we get going. When you go out and you get a job, y'all have a choice. Mm-hmm. Are you going to do your job or are you going to try to cut corners? If you get in the habit of trying to cut corners and not actually doing your job, that could lead to problems like termination. I do what my boss tells me to the best of my ability. And I think, you know, I kind of go a little overboard. It's because I believe in giving 110% in everything I do. That's just the way I was raised. So, good for some, not good for others, but everything has been consistent and everything's out there. So, I'm sure you'll all do fine and you'll all figure it out.
Yeah, it's good. But what's the new time to study? Give us one day to study this whole thing for the finals. It's not enough.
You should have been studying all along.
Yeah, we are studying. Like,
okay, so you'll be fine. I'm not worried about it. Unless you gave me a bad paper. And I'm going to start grading the papers. Some people have already submitted the papers. I'll start getting on them soon. I just spent one of my other classes I haven't taught since pre-COVID, and I just have to basically rebuild it. And then when we were here for COVID, we were like 3 weeks less. They cut our calendar. Because remember, everything got locked down, shut down. So it's just, that's been all my time. But I'm almost done with that for the semester, thank God. And I'll start getting the papers done. And in the papers, as I mentioned, not only will I tell you what you did right, what you did wrong, I will also break down what you need to get on the final. I think, as I said, to keep your current average or to bump your average up. So you'll know. Everything will be explained to you. Because, again, the problem that we have in this class is I can't do the extra credit question because it will screw up the percentages and it'll make your grade look worse than it is. So you'll know where you stand. Okay? All right. 7 Years' War, as we said, started by George Washington, would become the French and Indian War on this part of the world, but in Europe it was known as the 7 Years' War. And beginning in the 18th century, all of the little wars that they had started seeing a new element to international law. And that would be settlements with signed documents, signed treaties. And ironically, the treaties gave stuff to the winner at the expense of the loser. In terms of the French and Indian War, the treaty that settled it was the Treaty of Paris, 1763. Guess why it's called that? Guess where it was signed? In Paris. And guess what year it was signed? 1763. But this was emblematic of what I was just saying. Property changed hands. So, England was the winner of the French and Indian War. And as a reward, they took territory from the losers. England took New France, which we talked about, Eastern Canada, down the Mississippi River, New France, England got that. And England also took Spain, territory of Florida. In exchange, Spain got Louisiana and New Orleans. In France, they would be allowed to keep, I think, like Arcadia and a couple of islands down in the Caribbean. Why? Well, France was the big loser, so the loser had to pay. Now, FYI, post-American Revolution, Spain would get Florida back, and France would get Louisiana and New Orleans back. And eventually, we'd buy Louisiana and New Orleans, you know, when Jefferson was president, the Louisiana Purchase. And we would get Florida when Monroe was president, I believe. But anyways, that's the way it did. The winner gets, the loser pays. But the funny thing is none of these wars resulted in a complete win or a complete loss. So if we had a class where we could just focus on the 18th century, we'd see the reason why there was so many wars was one war sowed the seeds for the next, which sowed the seeds from the next. So the best example I can give you is the way World War I ended. That made World War II inevitable. Same thing during this time period. And what war did the French and Indian War trigger? Well, our war for independence, which would give birth to America. Now, who knows why? Anybody know why? What was the spark? What's the one thing that's true for all people that usually makes people lose their minds and do crazy, silly things? Drugs. Oh, yeah, okay, you got me on that. I wasn't really going down that route. But how do you get the drugs? With what?
Money.
Money, exactly. Money. The problem that would spark the French and Indian War was the bill for the war. By noon, if possible. All right. FYI. Fighting the French and Indian War, which resulted in the acquisition of New France, cost England the equivalent in today's money of about $35 billion. So, England had this big bill. So, in Parliament, they started simply asking, well, who should pay? The irony was is that for the most part, the battles here were fought by militiamen, colonists. So they were the ones who experienced the loss of blood and treasure. But what did they get? Well, if you know anything about the territory, the English colonies were all on the Atlantic coast and basically was ringed in by New France. Well, now France was gone, that was English territory. That suddenly meant the English could move all the way to the Mississippi, which means they could get more land, which we know will allow them to get more money, and eventually they'll be able to get more power. Traditionally, Parliament had the people in England actually. actually living in England pay these bills. But Parliament basically said, what benefit do the people in England get? Nothing. So, what did they decide? Well, it's only fair that the people who are going to benefit should bear at least part of the cost. Right? If you go to college and you decide to come and you get a big bill, you should pay it. Why? Well, because you're going to get a college degree, and that's going to allow you to make more money over your lifetime than if you didn't go to college. So you take on the debt to get the benefit. So Parliament basically said that to the colonists. Look, we got this debt, but you're going to benefit. So why don't you pay? But here is the problem. Up to this point, England had been practicing what's called salutary neglect. In other words, they were like a parent who allows their children to basically be free range. You know, so never at any point in their lives did they put up any type of boundaries. They never said no. So the little child grows into a teenager, comes into, you know, a young adult, ends up basically being a spoiled brat. The colonists had never been required to fully contribute to the mercantilist system. Yeah, England made laws on what could be produced and who could sell and where it could be sold, but the colonists, for the most part, never followed those laws. They pretty much did whatever they want because England was 3,000 miles away and there was little England could do to enforce the laws. So the colonists, up to this point, had grown up to basically be spoiled brats. Well, suddenly, the mother country asked the child to contribute for something that the child will benefit from. And what did the child do? Threw a freaking temper tantrum. Now, how did England put this out there? Well, England was a society, a constitutional monarchy, where the rule of law reigned. So these were not decrees made by the king, no. Parliament had sessions where they drafted these bills. There were debates. Heck, one thing that usually doesn't get included in American history books is that before all of the taxes and laws were put into effect, copies were sent to all of the colonial governments a year in advance. So they all knew what was coming. So it was not dropped on them. And under the mercantilist system, there was nothing new. There was nothing different. They passed taxes, they put duties, tariffs, things like that on it. For example, the Stamp Act was passed in 1763. I'm sure you've all heard a little bit about it. But what this was, to use modern socialist language, this essentially was a tax on the rich. Because this law required people to basically pay a tax on legal documents, newspapers, playing cards, and other liquor licenses. You know, it was just a tax. In order for those things to be valid, you got your thing and you had to go to a stamp collector, you paid the money, and they put a little stamp on it, like a notary seal, basically saying it's been paid for. The only people who had to pay the tax were the people that were buying newspapers or getting playing cards or were lawyers and they were making licenses and wills and things like that.
Who didn't have to pay the tax? The poor people. But this tax set off the people in the colonies. They were enraged. They began engaging not in peaceful protests, but acts of direct violence against government agents. In many instances, tax collectors were taken out of their offices and sometimes assaulted, but in worst case scenarios, they were tarred and feathered. Any of you ever hear about tarring and feathering? They literally poured scalding hot tar on your skin, and then while it was still wet, they put chicken feathers or turkey feathers all over you. So if you've ever done any driveway sealing and getting a little drop of tar on you, it basically like embeds itself to the skin and you kind of have to scrape it off. But if it's boiling, that means underneath it gets burned. So there were instances of people who were tarred and feathered. They got first, second, third degree burns over good portions of their body. The mobs also burned government offices. They burned the government stamps. So when things got out of control, Parliament then quickly passed another law. Notice I have in parentheses, the first Quartering Act. If any of you ever heard about the Quartering Act, you probably learned about the second. The second Quartering Act is where people were required to have soldiers in their houses. This was not that law. This was the first attempt. What this law said, basically, was that the towns and cities would have to pay for barracks for soldiers. Kind of like how your mom and dad, a portion of their property taxes, goes to paying for EMS, the police, the fire. So soldiers would be sent over because mobs were engaging in violence. And the reason why the soldiers came over was to basically reestablish law and order. Because I know there's a lot of people, particularly in your generation, that are in places in our country that think, you know, they can go out and protest and engage in violence and do anything they want. Well, the truth is, we live in a civil society based on laws, and you're not allowed to engage in those actions. So what does the government do using its legitimate powers? Will send soldiers over to reestablish law and order. Well, what did they do to that one? Well, they continued to protest. They literally threw fits of anger. And all up and down the coast, they organized in resistance movements. Of course, this famous decorative art was propaganda. I believe it was drawn by Benjamin Franklin. If he didn't draw it, I know it was published in his Poor Richard's Almanac. But what did the colonists do? Well, the different colonies started talking to one another and said, oh, maybe we need to get together and give a unified response to the Stamp Act. They held what was known as the Stamp Act Congress. Because after all, if you work together in a group, your words have more strength than if, you know, you have individual voices. Join or die. While the politicians were doing that, you also had terrorist groups organized, whose whole purpose was to basically rise up and resist the government. The most famous called themselves the Sons of Liberty. Now, the funny thing about the Sons of Liberty was that it was started by the man who had to pay the most taxes, John Hancock, who was one of the wealthiest people in the city of Boston, whose family was engaged in shipping.
Because of that, he had to pay the duties. Every time a ship came into the harbor, he had to get it checked. You know, they went through the manifest, they saw the items that were taxable, and before the ship, the stuff could be offloaded, you had to pay the tax. Of course, Hancock made even more money by smuggling. Because New England has a large coast. He would constantly have his ships pull up close to the coast somewhere out away from a harbor, like around Cape Cod, or maybe South Shore, North Shore. And then the stuff that was taxed would be illegally offloaded and rowed to shore. Well, Hancock was angry that the government was taking his money, that the government was taxing the rich people like him. So what does he do? Well, he makes friends with a failure at business, Samuel Adams, and he basically paid him to create an activist group, because Samuel Adams, while he was bad at business, he was a good orator. He could get people riled up. And they literally began taking to the streets of Boston protesting about how fair it is that the rich people have to pay taxes. So, Parliament listened. Fine. The people don't like it. Fine. You don't like the Stamp Act because you can see it. It's like a sales tax. It's added on the receipt. Fine, you don't like that? Then we'll get rid of that and we'll go back to the old way of doing things. We'll go from what's known as a direct tax, where the consumer pays the tax, to indirect taxes that the consumer does not see. So we have an instance of direct versus indirect. Direct tax, sales tax. Any non-food source or clothing item in Massachusetts, when you buy it, you go to the cash register and you have the government add on to the price 6.25%. States like New Hampshire, you don't pay sales taxes. Massachusetts, you do. You know that if you're going to go out and buy a new laptop or a new iPhone, a lawnmower, a book, that price is going to get added on and you can see it on the receipt. And you know if you don't want to pay the tax, you don't buy the item. Well, traditionally, governments use duties. These would be taxed that the shipper, the middle guy, would have to pay. Because when the boat pulled into the harbor, the tax was then paid. The price for those goods then would go up. Because the wholesaler was not going to lose the money. The example of this that I will give you is the gas taxes that you pay. Do you realize that in Massachusetts, regardless of the price of gas, every single gallon you put into your vehicle, you're paying about 50 cents per gallon? You aware of that? The greatest irony is that the government, and it's, I put taxes because about, I think it's 20 cents goes to the federal government and 30 cents goes to the state government. The government actually makes more per gallon than gas companies do.
Because the gas company, to get the gas to the gas station,
has to pay all the licensing fees, all of the wages to the employees that pull the gas up. They have to pay insurance, health care. Plus, they have to pay the taxes on their vehicles and all the equipment, which are considered personal property items, and they're taxed annually. Plus, you have to get the gas processed and then have a refinery. There are taxes. There's just taxes upon taxes upon taxes that are built in. That's ultimately what determines the price at the pump. But at the end of the day, in terms of profit, gas companies, they make about 10 cents per gallon. But again, you'd never know because when you pump, they don't calculate the tax you're paying separately. It's built into the price.
Well, that's what the Townsend Acts were. So instead of there being that direct sales tax like the stamp tax, they started requiring import duties on things like glass, lead, paint, items that were actually consumed by more people. But again, when you went to the store, that price was built in and the cost went up a little bit, but you didn't see that extra thing being added on. That's the way it was always done. No one had any issues with it. But guess what the Sons of Liberty started doing? Although in fairness, the one aspect of the Townsend Acts that John Hancock in particular didn't like was what was created were special courts called Admiralty Courts that would be put up in every single major port. Massachusetts had one in Salem and one in Boston. There was one in Providence. There was one in New Haven. There was one in New York City. If a merchant was suspected of not paying the duties, they would have their case heard in an admiralty court. Specialized courts to handle violations of the law, the duties, the taxes. Okay, fine. You're innocent until proven guilty. You're allowed to have your day in court. What could the Sons of Liberty be angry about? The trials in the Admiralty Court are what's known as bench courts. Bench trials. Anyone know what a bench trial is?
If you go in and you are accused of a criminal action, the trial is heard before a judge and a jury. But if you go in and you are accused of a civil infraction, in which you're going to be fined, you can request a jury, but if you don't request a jury, you have your full trial before just the judge. That's a bench trial. So the judge is the judge and the jury. Well, what did the Sons of Liberty complain about? Go all the way back to the English Bill of Rights, where the right of trial by jury was guaranteed. So they sat back and said, it's not fair.
Questions? Well, the problem with spoiled kids is they want their way no matter what. Regardless of the truth. Regardless of facts. Because they are selfish. Narcissistic.
So, and by the way, the Townsend Acts would later be amended. Parliament kept trying to work with the colonists, but every inch that Parliament gave, the colonists demanded a foot. And when you pump people up,
constantly over and over and over again. Eventually what's going to happen is an explosion. And that occurred in Boston in March 5th, 1770. On that day, a young man, I think his name was Sam, I can't remember his last name, a kid, he was about 15 years old. He got mad at a soldier who was stationed in Boston, a soldier by the name of Hugh White. Because under British custom, the soldiers who acted like police basically worked a full-time job, but when they were not on duty, they had a lot of downtime. So what a lot of these, we'll call them English soldiers, as opposed to British, what these English soldiers did is when they weren't on duty to make extra money, they went out and got part-time jobs. And Hugh White just happened to get a part-time job working in a barber shop because he wanted to make some cash, which he could send home to his mother. Well, the problem is when Hugh White got that job, the 15-year-old kid did not. So the 15-year-old kid being a kid, and that's the reason why I don't have any or much compassion for what kids say, because kids know nothing. Well, this kid threw a little hissy fit and went and started confronting Hugh White, screaming at him, swearing at him, one night when Hugh White was on duty. Hugh White, being an adult, did what I would probably do in a situation. When the kid got up in his face and started spitting in his face, he took the butt end of his rifle and kind of said, "Get away from me, kid." And Sam, I think his name was Sam, he fell down. And he hurt his little bum. And he started to cry. And so he went running, going wee, 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 all the way down to one of the local bars. Because there was no drinking age. And he went in there and he started saying how he was assaulted by a soldier. And who listened? A bar full of drunken sailors. Because back in the 1770s, when the Little Ice Age was still raging, Boston Harbor literally used to freeze. And if you had a ship, you could not sail in and out during the wintertime. So they would always make sure to get the ships into dock by like October, and they basically would hunker down for the winter. So the sailors made their money during the summertime, and then they had all winter to do nothing other than drink. So on this particular cold evening, the kid goes in, he's like, "Where, where, where?" All the souls are like, "We're going to get," because we all know human beings, particularly men, make the best decisions after they've had many pints of adult alcoholic beverages. And so what does this mob do? They go down and they're gonna give this adult a piece of their mind. And they show up and they start screaming at him. It's cold, there's snow, there's ice. Start picking up chunks of ice and throwing it. Chunks of cobblestone, frozen horse manure. Whatever they can get their hands on, he's thrown at him. So he does what a soldier slash police officer would do. He calls for backup. And about 8 other soldiers, plus an officer by the name of Captain Preston, came out, formed a line, and basically began telling the mob to go home. But did they? No. They only escalated. They screamed. They swore. They threatened. But you know what some of them did, which was really stupid? They taunted the soldiers, daring them to fire.
Now, have any of you been in a crowded situation? Like a sporting event, pep rally, concert? And everyone's talking and there's lots of noise, there's lots of shouting. And every now and then you just randomly pick up like weird words.
Well, now put yourself in the position of the soldiers. Even though Captain Preston explicitly told them not to fire, these were muzzle-loaded rifles. Take about a minute to load. So they went out and everything was primed and ready to go. Captain Preston, as the mob begins getting closer and soldiers start getting hit with stuff, tells them then to take firing position. Why? Because their muskets had bayonets on them. And who in their right mind would walk into a bayonet? But then we don't know exactly what happened. It's possible that someone got hit in the head and accidentally discharged, or it could have been someone thinking that Captain Preston gave him an order to fire, but the firing line fired one volley, boom, into the crowd of drunken sailors.
And count them, five people got shot.
That's usually what happens when you have a mob of people standing in front of people with guns, and the guns are fired.
Crispus Attucks, Samuel Gray, James Caldwell, Patrick Carr, all who had vicious reputations of being violent brawlers, street fighters, all fell down dead. The only innocent bystander was a kid by the name of Samuel Maverick, not the same kid. When the mobs went out, someone started ringing the church bells. And that was a sign that a fire had erupted. And so people woke up and they came out to see where the fire was. So one of the bullets traveling in a straight line happened to go in and penetrate, like winning the lottery, or in a bad way, penetrated Mr. Young Maverick right in the throat, fell over dead. But the mob triggered bloodshed. So what does the Sons of Liberty do? They don't tell the truth. They use propaganda. This is an image that was engraved by none other than Paul Revere. He named it the Bloody Massacre perpetrated on King Street. And he intentionally used, manipulated the image that would be printed in newspapers by making sure all of the soldiers had smiles on their faces and they were leaning forward to make sure that they could get kills. And notice how he put the crowd, men, women, children, all dressed in their Sunday finest, looking scared, crying, and sad, and shocked at how brutal and oppressive the government was.
You know what they didn't have? They didn't have video. They didn't have street cameras. The soldiers didn't have body cams on them. So, what was the message spread about this event throughout the colonies? This, not the truth. And by the way, there was a trial. All the soldiers were put on trial. And only two of them were found guilty, not of murder, but of manslaughter. And the only reason why the two soldiers got charges of manslaughter is because all the soldiers drew straws and they accepted the punishment because their lawyer, John Adams, basically said the only way to get tensions down is someone has to get a little bit of blame. Because back then, if you're found guilty of manslaughter, you basically had a hot iron that burned an M into your thumb. But John Adams got them all off on murder simply by sharing the facts. Because as John Adams said, facts are funny things. But what this was an explosion, so to speak, that went up and down the East Coast. Because now in the minds of more and more colonists, their government, if they don't obey, is going to kill them. You know, all the lies about, you know, systemic racism and all the stuff that, you know, erupted during the so-called Summer of Love in 2020. All of the propaganda, all of the lies, all of the spin. Same exact thing. So, to de-escalate the situation, Parliament worked really hard over the next couple of years to try and do their best to kind of keep those things that were inciting the mob from coming into play. But in 1773, Parliament indirectly, unintentionally triggered a situation that it once again escalated because it was manipulated by the propaganda of the terrorists, the Sons of Liberty. This was a little event that occurred once again in Boston called the Boston Tea Party. All right, long story short, make it simple. One of the towns in Acts was a duty that was placed on tea. Tea was imported primarily from India. And under the British mercantile system, the tea was harvested in India, sailed to London, where it would be offloaded and taxed, and then put on a boat, sailed over here, and then a second tax was applied to it. A tax when it went into London, a tax when it went into Boston. But it was illegal for the ship to go from India to Boston. So it increased the price. In charge of the operation was a licensed business called the East India Company. Sometimes in books they refer to it as the British East India Company, so people don't get confused with the Dutch East India Company. But long story short, this company had the monopoly given to them by law, by the crown. Because as England was basically taking control of India, they didn't send soldiers and colonize it. They allowed the businesses to make deals with the local rajas, the local leaders. So in exchange for that, England basically said, you're the only company under the British flag that can do business there. So you got that quid pro quo. Problem was, the Indians produced way more tea than the people of the British Empire were consuming. So you started having massive stockpiles of tea worth millions and millions of dollars that were on the verge of going bad because tea does spoil. If they lost their inventory of tea, the British East Company could close, which would mean England would lose its contacts in India, and maybe France would go in and take it. So, long story short, Parliament came up with a compromise called the Tea Act. A compromise that would be good for everybody. Under this law, the British East India Company was no longer required to go to London. Instead, their ships could sail directly to the colonies. So the tea could get here quicker. And because you eliminate that requirement to go to London first, that actually reduced the price of tea
by about 3 cents per pound. So as the result of this law, tea prices in America, because the indirect taxes were reduced, went down. They were getting it cheaper. I mean, how often, I mean, in your life, have you ever heard of an incident where the government gets rid of a tax? Well, here's the thing. The prices dropped so low that John Hancock could no longer profit from smuggling. Because he began smuggling in shiploads of tea that didn't pay either tax. And thus was cheaper. But now, because there's more British East India Company ships, they're going to be able to increase the supply. The price already is less, and when you increase the supply, prices go down. So Parliament was hitting Hancock's bottom line. And what do rich people not like doing? Losing money. So what does he do? Well, he whips up the Sons of Liberty again. But apparently, he got a bunch of allies as well. Because on a cold December evening, December 16th, a bunch of Mohawk Indians were seen coming out of bars operated by people friendly with the Sons of Liberty, like the Green Dragon. And these Mohawk Indians then progressed down to the harbor, surrounded by cheering people. And then these Indians rowed out to where there were three British East India Company ships anchored in the harbor that had just pulled in the day before, but had yet to offload their cargo. And these Indians then climbed on board, because apparently the Indians don't like tea, because we know what they did then. They dumped crate after crate after crate after crate of tea. 342 crates alone, which equaled 90,000 pounds of tea. Because again, the Indians don't like tea. Now, just FYI, the Mohawk Indians hadn't been present in Massachusetts since before the arrival of the Pilgrims. So it's amazing that suddenly they reappeared and had issue with tea.
But what did they do? Well, they destroyed private property. If you remember, one of the basic tenets of the Enlightenment was the belief in the right of private property. And one of the obligations of the government is to protect private property.
But what did these Indians do? They destroyed private property. Now, it was one thing when they were protesting the Stamp Act, because they were attacking government offices. But now, they're attacking the private property of businesses.
We know what happens when the government doesn't protect businesses. Do you see what happened in Minneapolis? During that summer of love? How many minority-owned businesses were destroyed when the mobs were running rampant?
Well, England decided, we can't allow this to go on. Because if we allow, it's like the broken windows theory of criminal justice. If you allow a criminal to do a small thing, the next time it's going to get bigger. So England basically said, we can't allow this to stand. So they decide to try to punish just the people of Boston.
When they passed a series of laws that the Sons of Liberty would later spin and call them, through propaganda, the Intolerable Acts. But each of these laws, I think, are reasonable. Do I have them? I don't. So I'll have to read them. although you do all have your little Google devices, and I know you like playing on your little, your little phones and watching your little videos, so you can look them up. They are Google. One, Boston Port Act. First law, Boston Port Act. This law shut down Boston Harbor until the damages were paid. Boston Port Act. Boston Harbor. Nothing would come in, nothing would go out until the damages were paid. Two, Massachusetts Government Act. The Massachusetts Government Act. Massachusetts Government Act. This law suppressed the colonial government. Because many people in the Sons of Liberty were elected officials in the colonial assembly. They were selectmen or eldermen in their towns. So all of the government in the colony was suspended. And in its place came martial law. So a military governor took over. And justice would be enforced by judges handpicked by that governor. And marshals to go get criminals would be handpicked by the governor. Until those who were responsible were brought to justice and the damages were paid. So, no government, no elections, until those who were guilty are brought to justice and the damages were paid. Three, the Administration of Justice Act. The Administration of Justice Act. Administration Justice Act. To make it simple, if a government agent broke a law to find those responsible, the trial would be in England, not Boston. So, if a soldier broke the door off its hinges, and they found one of the Mohawk Indians. Under our legal system, the Indian would have the right to sue for compensatory damages. Because the government doesn't have the right to knock your door off your hinges. The problem is that trial, you would have to go over to England. For the vast majority of people who were over in the colonies at the time couldn't afford to take about a year off to go sue somebody over a door. But why did they do it? Well, they wanted to make sure that the government agents would be allowed to find those responsible for the destruction of the tea. Oh, and last, the last part of the Intolerable Acts, the Second Quartering Act. This is the one where the soldiers had to live in the houses. But here's the catch. Whose houses do you think the soldiers lived in? Do they think they lived in the poor people's houses? The people that pretty much only had a one-room house? Where, like, the kitchen, the bathroom, everything was all in one room with the dirt floor? Or do you think it was in the rich people's houses? Like the rich people who were basically paying for the Sons of Liberty. Just kind of saying. Well, when this occurred, people in Massachusetts decided to rise up because the consequences of trying to hold the Sons of Liberty responsible impacted every man and woman and child in what then was called the province of Massachusetts Bay. And that caused people to take up arms and rebel. Judges, officials across the state were removed. The judges that were appointed by the military governor. The colonists started making citizen councils. But one of the most famous incidents that started the whole row of dominoes was the actual start of the War for Independence. And none of you probably have heard about it. And it's sad because it took place right down the road in Worcester, Massachusetts. On September 6, 1774, a contingency of 4,622 citizens in the form of a militia marched into Worcester and shut down the courthouse. There were men from all 37 towns in Worcester County. The largest contingency came from my hometown of Sutton. But 800 of the people came from Sutton. Because us Suttonians were very rebellious. But here's the amazing thing. The militiamen lined the streets. They all had their guns. But not a single incident of violence occurred. The judge and his staff were basically told to leave the courthouse. And they had to renounce the oath to enforce the military governor's will. Granted, they did have to walk the gauntlet. And I don't know about any of you guys and gals. I'd probably say anything if I had to walk down the street where both sides of the street are lined with guys with guns. Probably do whatever they want. It's particularly 4,000 plus of them. But nonetheless, they peaceably shut down the system. And of course, you don't know about it because no one died. But once Worcester was toppled, the same thing happened in Springfield. It would happen in Salem. It would happen down in Plymouth. Town after town after town, all of the courthouses began being shut down. So by the winter of 1775, the only thing that the military governor controlled was the little peninsula that was once Boston. Of course, Boston is now like five times the size of landfill. But at one point, it was just a tiny little peninsula. But the rest of the state basically rose up, demanding their rights as free Englishmen. And one of the rights that free people have under our system is the right to keep and bear arms. But the only way to fight against the government was the collection of ammunition dumps. Barrels of powder, boxes of shot. Because they didn't control the whole state, what the colonists began doing is basically engaging in mass collections and moving them closer to Boston. Because one of the plans was they were going to basically march a military force and prevent the soldiers from leaving the city. But the governor got word of it, Tommy Gage. So, early in the morning, on April 19th, a contingency of about 700 British soldiers marched out under the cover of darkness with the purpose of going to Concord, Massachusetts, because the governor found out that there was a huge arsenal of gunpowder and shot in guns. So he was going to take the guns away, because you can't fight against the government if you don't have weapons. Well, the problem is the Sons of Liberty had spies One of the most famous one was another man you never heard of. Now I'm having a brain fart too. It will come to me. But anyways, he was the one who organized the system where Paul Revere was one of three riders who would go by different groups, different routes, in the event that the British left the city. They were the ones who put the beacon, you know, in the North Church, which was the highest point in the city back then. You know, one lantern if by land, two if by sea. Paul Revere, even though the play said it was Paul Revere that did that, he didn't. He was already out of the city. He, William Dawes, and I can never remember the third guy. I'm getting old. I'm having brain fots, but whatever. They were planned and waiting. They saw the lights, and then they began riding quickly to Concord to basically warn that the Redcoats were coming. Now, they did not say British, because the colonists viewed themselves as British. But the soldiers were commonly referred to as either redcoats or lobster backs, bloody backs, things like that. Now, of course, Dawes and Revere did not make it. They were actually intercepted. But rather, it was the third guy, another guy who I can't remember, who also was a doctor. Just don't remember his name. It's hard to do a lot of this by memory. So anyways, the third guy gets there and warns Samuel Adams and John Hancock that the Redcoats are coming. Samuel Adams, John Hancock, sends out a warning, and about 4,000 Minutemen rose up and was ready for them. Of course, Adams and Hancock ran out to, coincidentally, Sutton, because Hancock had a house in Sutton. But as the Redcoats got closer, they came into the center of Lexington about daybreak. And in a common area, the Lexington Green, they were met by about 70 soldiers. The commanding officer told the colonists to go home. Oh, and drop your guns. The colonists were like, no, we're not going to drop our guns. We have a God-given right to keep and bear arms. So as they were walking off with their gun, something happened. Don't know who fired it, don't know what caused it, but a gunshot went off. Both sides fired a volley at each other, and in the end, several colonists ended up dead. And they quickly pulled their compatriots and fled the Lexington Green. The soldiers then ransacked downtown Lexington, breaking into homes, breaking into stores, looking for guns and powder and shot. And when they found none, and an informant told them, it's down the road in Concord, they continued their march. They go through a dense set of trees, come around a corner, cross what was known as the North Bridge, and entered the bottom of a bowl of a field. Up on top, there's where the arsenal was, in a barn. But ringing the bowl were those 4,000 men, with guns pointed downhill. Over the next several hours, the militiamen opened fire on the Redcoats. The Redcoats returned fire. But along the way, 73 Redcoats were killed, 174 were wounded, and 26 missing in action. On the colonist side, 50 dead, 39 wounded, 5 missing in action. This was just not a mob event. This was an armed insurrection. The citizens took up arms and shot at their government, and the government returned fire. And now we have an ideological conundrum. John Locke's social contract. Job of the government is to protect the lives, the liberty, and the property of the people. The job of the people is to obey the government. We now have mutual breaches. The government shot the people, and the people shot the government. And it only escalated.
Because once the soldiers retreated back to Boston, the militia moved forward. And you can't tell now because it's all urban sprawl, but there was a point when the tiny little peninsula of Boston was rung by all of the towns that all had high ground. And the militia moved in and basically took all the high positions. Eventually, they would get guns from Fort Ticonderoga that had the ability to shoot anywhere in the peninsula.
But one of the closest points was an outcropping in Cambridge, which comprised of two hills. The higher hill was Bunker, the lower hill was Breeds, but Breeds was closer to the city. So the colonists made two military positions, one on Breeds, one on Bunker. Breeds was so close that guys with rifles could actually shoot into the city. So what does Thomas Gage do? He sends his soldiers out, sends out 2,600 of them to get the colonists off the city. Because Tommy Gage was not only concerned with the lives of the soldiers, but all of the men and women and children that was still in the city of Boston. Because you know what happens when people shoot into cities? People die. But of course, we know what ended up happening. The British would land in Charlestown. They would try marching up. It would take them three times, but eventually they would throw the colonists off. But at a shockingly high death rate. 226 British soldiers shot dead. Another 828 wounded.
Compared to
140 American dead, 271 wounded.
30 prisoners of war. The discrepancy was the result of an order that the commanding officer on Bunker Hill gave to the men both on Bunker and Breeds.
The officer, Israel Putnam of Connecticut, ordered the men to not fire until you see the whites of their eye.
The reason being is they were using smoothbore muskets. So it was just a steel tube. And when you fire a smoothbore musket, the ball kind of bounces down the barrel. Which means when it gets out to the end, you've all done linear equations. You know, if you change the angle, even a fraction, when you take it out to the farthest point, it's going to go high, it's going to go low. So long story short, these rifles, if you got behind beyond 100 yards, you probably couldn't hit the side of, well, whatever the building over there where the cafeteria is called. But if you're within 50 yards, when you can make out the whites of the people's eyes, these things are lethal. I'd rather get shot by an AR-15 than one of these. They fired slugs of lead that traveled at near supersonic speed, and they melted and warped. So you didn't just have a nice little clean bullet that went in. You had this big flat blob like gum and smeared that basically blasted into you, shattered everything, and came out your backside. Plus they were shooting downhill.
Now we have military action. What are we going to do? Well, we'll have to save that for Tuesday. Questions?
Papers. Any last questions on the papers? Remember, two things. Proflomatic.com, look at where you're going to lose points if you don't follow directions. Two, when you do drop it and engage, make sure you submit it as the final draft. Okay? Good luck. Have a nice weekend. We'll see you on Tuesday.